Dr. Scott Moore has been a member at the Athenaeum since 2016. And as soon as I started in July, we had a conversation about his current work and the idea of bringing more conversations about science, the environment, and sustainability to the Athenaeum, issues that affect our daily lives. And so he worked with me to create a series that he is kicking off today, but that will include Michael Weisberg on Monday, November 25th, talking about sea lions in the Galapagos, and Richard Weller on December 10th about designing a planet for better or worse, about urban planning and sustainability. So this proves to be an exciting and interesting series that should engage all of our minds and stretch all of us. Now, Scott is a political scientist. He is the director of the Penn Global China Program and a senior fellow at the Kleinman Center for Energy Policy and the Water Center at Penn. And he also, raise your hand in the back, he brought some of his colleagues with him. We're delighted to have you here and hope that you and anyone else who is a guest will come and visit more often. Prior to entering the academic world as a scholar, Moore was a young professional and water resources management specialist at the World Bank Group, an Environment, Science, and Technology and Health Center for China in the U.S. Department of State, where he worked extensively on the Paris Agreement for Climate Change. So he's coming in with a wealth of not only scholarly knowledge, but on-the-ground knowledge of what is happening with our climate and what our needs are. His current book, from which he is drawing this conversation, is Subnational Hydropolitics: Conflict, Cooperation, and Institution Building in Shared River Basins. We're not selling it because it's Oxford University Press. As he pointed out, they're about $80 a book. But you may check it out of our library if you would like to read it when you are done, and we hope you will. Right now, I would like to ask you to join me in welcoming Scott Moore for his conversation. Thank you.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming. It's a pleasure for me to be here today. I'm relatively new to Philadelphia. I had no prior connection to the city before 2016 when my wife and I moved here. She did grow up in the area, but I sadly had no previous connection to this region. But on the very first weekend after we moved here, I was wandering around this area around Washington Square, stumbled on the Athenaeum. I guess actually it was a Friday, it must have been, and I came in to see the exhibit at the time and joined on the spot because I think it is such a great little gem, and I just love the idea of it being such a repository of knowledge, as well as a great opportunity for the community to kind of share knowledge on a wide range of subjects. On that note, a lot of the talks that I've been to at the Athenaeum have been kind of more on the kind of historical or humanistic side, which is a little bit different than what I spend most of my day thinking about, which is kind of very much either in the here and now with environmental issues or thinking about the implications of those issues over the next couple decades. That being said, there certainly is no sharp division between past, present, and future. And in fact, what I hope to kind of do is weave together a little bit of a story about how those different phases of time fit together in the case of water and are kind of, in a sense, wrapped up in a bow by this very region, by Philadelphia and southeastern Pennsylvania. I also want to just kind of by way of introducing kind of the topic and thinking about water issues both globally and locally, tell you a little bit about why I came to be interested in these issues and how I came to study them. And that really starts with where I did grow up, which is Kentucky, like Pennsylvania, a coal state. And I had the unusual pleasure of when I was a child getting to know one of the state's relatively few environmental lawyers, In his spare time, he was actually my soccer coach for 8 seasons in a neighborhood soccer league that I played in. And while I didn't improve at all in those 8 seasons, I did get to know a little bit about environmental law and his work. And really, in the state of Kentucky, the Commonwealth of Kentucky, actually, like another connection to Pennsylvania, being an environmental lawyer really means interacting with coal companies, usually suing them, and very often suing them for releases of the kind of waste or detritus of coal mining into waterways. And so from a pretty young age, I was pretty interested in kind of climate change and energy on one hand, and with a little bit of this interest in water on the other. When I was in college, that kind of evolved a little bit into an interest with China, and as was kindly noted in the introduction, my main role at Penn actually is to run an interdisciplinary China program with a particular focus on sustainability and technology issues. But so I then went to China, spent a few years there after I graduated from college, and my specific research interest was essentially what China thought about climate change as a global issue. This was particularly before a landmark climate negotiation that took place in 2009, and the idea was to try to get a handle on what the stance of the Chinese government would be kind of going into that negotiation. Well, one of the things that I learned while I was there is that policymakers in China were intently concerned about changes in the distribution and availability of water within China, both in terms of changes in runoff in the major rivers, the Yangtze, the Yellow, the Brahmaputra, as well as coastal and inland flooding. And that's kind of when it hit me that from a human point of view, an admittedly slightly selfish human point of view, when we think about climate change and what we're really concerned about in terms of the implications and impacts of climate change, it really more or less boils down to changes in the distribution and availability of water, both in terms of times and places in which we might have too much and times and places in which we can expect to have too little. And that really launched me into thinking about kind of water resources and water resource management specifically. At the same time that water is a very global story in its connection to climate change, it's also an intensely local one with respect to this region in Philadelphia. And really that's because by historical fortune, fate, circumstance, Philadelphia is a city that really grew up with the Industrial Revolution. We have a city that was sort of founded when the first kind of twinklings of the dawn of the Industrial Revolution were appearing on the horizon, really grew up with the Industrial Revolution as it broadened from its origins in Europe, especially parts of the UK, over to North America, and then evolved really into the kind of historical period that we're in now, which is really more of sort of a post-industrial era. And really that's significant in the context of water, because the water challenges that we face both globally and locally are really an outgrowth of the Industrial Revolution and our industrial societies. At the same time, the solutions to those challenges really kind of stem from what I would argue or say is really kind of more of a post-industrial society or landscape. Just to sort of try to illustrate that a little bit further, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from the annual report of the chief engineer of the Philadelphia Water Department for the year 1884 regarding the Schuylkill. So this excerpt begins with saying much of the same message I'd like to deliver in general. The history of the Schuylkill is both interesting and instructive. In earlier days, a noble river with a bountiful and healthful drainage area of woodland, mountain, and meadow, pouring a powerful and fairly equable current of pure water through its channel, the occupancy of its valley and the growth and development of population and industries from source to mouth have greatly modified its characteristics. Generation after generation have made fresh inroads upon its resources and added its quota of varied pollution, until at length the river, whose pure volume for a long period was able to eliminate the evidence of man's careless work and presence, and which even yet might have continued to do so were it not Samson-like shorn of its power of conservation by the ruthless cutting away of the forests and clearing of the land upon which it depended to equalize its flow, has become a sewage and trade-polluted stream whose failing volume in seasons of drought is unequal to the nauseous task of digesting and disposing of the extraneous and dangerous matters with which it is surcharged. This is the story of every water body in the world, essentially, at least every water body that has been subject to kind of this process of industrial development, which at this point is almost every major water body in the world. But particularly, there are three kind of main issues that you can see even in this this very relatively early description of what was happening to the Schuylkill in, again, the relatively early phases of that industrial development that we can really point to as still occurring in most parts of the world and are really, you know, it's just kind of interesting to think about this coming from 1884. You could essentially take that description and make it a news article about most major rivers in China or India or Nigeria. We're kind of seeing the same story unfolding across different parts of the world. But what are those three major kind of elements and challenges that frame both the challenge that the Schuylkill faced in the late 19th century and many water bodies around the world continue to face today? Well, the first of those challenges is, again, and think about this in the context of industrialization, the development of an industrialized society. Even though we have a fairly large amount of fresh water on planet Earth, and even though that amount of water doesn't change appreciably over time, it's very unevenly distributed geographically around the world. So much so, in fact, that even in relatively water-rich areas like southeastern Pennsylvania, you almost never have enough water to satisfy all needs or demands that you might have in a given place. And this was certainly the case in the Schuylkill, which the passage here about the growth and development of population and industries from source to mouth really reflects. So again, you take virtually any body of water anywhere in the world, and what you'll see is extensive modification of that body of water as a result of industrialization. You'll see the development of storage. So here, this is usually when you're talking about building a dam or a reservoir to store or impound water, diversions. So when you have canals, irrigation diversions, ditches, things like that, that will take water away from the main stem of a river and devote it elsewhere. All of these modifications are sort of an inherent and critical part of the process of industrial development. And the sort of challenge that creates almost inherently, almost automatically, is how do you really determine how that water, that limited quantity of water in a given place is allocated? How do you determine how much of it can be used by farmers, how much of it you reserve for the use of urban residents, factories, hydropower, to say nothing of keeping a certain amount of water in the stream, the lake, the river for fishermen to protect the environment, et cetera. So one challenge that we continue to see around the world is how you deal with that issue of water kind of quantity and allocation. And it should also kind of be point out that usually the way that we solve that problem, whether it's Philadelphia in the late 1800s, China and India today, is to build an extensive network of infrastructure that allows us to tap not just the freshwater resources locally around an area of dense settlement or a city, but from much further away. So if you were to look at the network of reservoirs and pipes that supply the major metro areas in this part of Pennsylvania, whether it be Philadelphia or Allentown, Bethlehem, the water that those cities use, for the most part, comes from tens of miles away, a watershed that extends really quite far outside the boundaries of the city itself. And that's a pattern that you see repeated around the world, so that as you have the growth of cities and as you have urbanization, what you create is this immense footprint that's required to bring water from where it kind of quantitatively exists in a natural state to where it's needed by humans for human economic activity. That challenge is even greater when you start talking about water use for agriculture. And if you were to go, to the Great Plains, most of the water used for irrigation in the Great Plains comes from a massive underground aquifer, the Ogallala Aquifer, where you'll have a giant, if you've either been to this area or even more particularly flown over it, you'll see these giant circles kind of spaced out across the landscape. And that's for something called center pivot irrigation, where you've got a well essentially in the center and you suck up groundwater and then spray it in a circle around where the well head is. That type of water use means that you're drawing from basically a giant bowl of water beneath the surface. So again, you're really kind of drawing water not just from a confined sort of local area, but really quite a large area. So this is sort of challenge one, is how you get the sheer amount of water that you need to the place that you need it. And that is a challenge that's getting ever more difficult and ever more acute as the human population grows, as we urbanize more and more intensely around the world. The second challenge, which this kind of passage gets at the very end when it talks about a failing volume in seasons of drought, which I think is kind of interesting. You certainly don't think of the Schuylkill as a river which is very often prone to conditions of drought. But the second kind of challenge that we see around the world is not only having water in the right place, but also at the right time. So again, when we think about the water that we use and need as humans, it's not evenly spaced out throughout the year. Again, thinking about this particularly in the context of agriculture, obviously you have a planting season, you have a growing season where the majority of your water use would be concentrated. But even in cities, we tend to use more water during the summer, for example, than during other months. So it's not, the demand isn't evenly spaced out across the year. Nor, of course, is precipitation. Lots of parts of the world, you have a rainy season. In more temperate climates like this, we also tend to have more rainfall in the spring and fall than during the summer and the winter. Well, you might have guessed where I'm going with this in terms of scale of the global challenge. Climate change is around the world really disrupting historical patterns of particularly rainfall availability. It's much harder for us to predict when we'll have precipitation or rainfall events and how much water those events will create. So it's becoming more and more of a challenge to know how much water we're going to get from those events and then when exactly it's going to come. If you've heard or read about several of the major kind of recent water crises, there was one in 2018 that afflicted Cape Town, South Africa, where the city came within about 2 weeks of essentially having to totally turn off the taps. People would have had to kind of revert to almost a pre-industrial kind of lifestyle of going to get water from community collection points. Or just this past summer in Chennai, India, where a similar event unfolded and the main municipal reservoir came very close to emptying out, which would have, again, essentially meant the taps would have run dry. Both of those cases were due, well, as many crises are, to a number of things, but the biggest kind of cause or issue there was that historical rainfall patterns had been disrupted, and the dry season, essentially, in both of those regions had extended much further than had historically been the case and that the municipal water authorities had therefore planned for. They therefore hadn't enacted conservation measures or things that might have allowed them to store enough water for those cities to make it through the drier period. Fortunately, in both of those cases, a combination of sort of conservation, crisis management, and good fortune in terms of when rainfall did come allowed those cities to avert catastrophe. But it certainly won't be very long before the next such case occurs. That indeed, at this point, it's more or less an annual kind of occurrence somewhere in the world. And of course, at some point, a city so afflicted will not be so fortunate, and you will have a case where the taps in a major world city will run dry, which of course is something we have not seen in modern history, essentially, which will be an interesting event to witness. We can certainly talk more about that if people are interested. The third, and in many ways biggest, part of the world's water challenge actually has not to do with quantity of water, but rather quality. That is, of course, a large focus of this passage that I read to you, which really more or less is talking about the Schuylkill becoming polluted to the point of kind of almost uselessness, but particularly this passage where it talks about the Schuylkill having become a sewage and trade polluted stream. One thing, having just kind of talked to you a little bit about the dangers and issues inherent in water quantity challenges, we do have pretty good technical solutions to water scarcity. And again, I can talk in some detail about this if people are interested, but usually with enough money, with enough kind of technical resources, you can usually find, you know, an untapped stream or lake somewhere that you can import water from, you can desalinate. There are ways to kind of engineer yourself out of that problem. Much harder is the problem of water quality, and when you don't have enough clean water, or when you don't have water in the right qualitative state to use for the purpose that you require, as well as when you don't have enough people who have access to that clean water. This is, of course, a well-known kind of challenge around the globe. Recent figures kind of suggest that about 800 million people around the world don't have access to any kind of dependably clean source of water. That's probably low in terms of an estimate. So it's an enormous problem. And even here in a place like Philadelphia or in the United States, this is kind of an issue and a problem that we're facing some new challenges with because of aging infrastructure, because of new contaminants, and again, I can go into that in more detail if people are interested, but essentially new chemical substances that we've introduced into our water supply that we don't know yet a lot about what the long-term health impacts are. So now people are starting to kind of question, do we need to be filtering or treating the water to try to remove these chemicals? Currently, we don't even really monitor or regulate them, let alone remove or treat them. But suffice it to say, this issue of water quality is really in some ways the hardest problem that we face. And it also kind of bears maybe mention that in addition to kind of presenting a human health risk for drinking water for humans, it's also an enormous ecological challenge. And in fact, the dominant source of water pollution around the world are actually agricultural fertilizers and pesticides that wash into streams and rivers. That causes a number of bad ecological effects, but the biggest and best known is eutrophication, where essentially you have blooms of algae and other microorganisms that suck up the oxygen in water bodies and then leave too little oxygen for fish and other aquatic species to survive. And that challenge is also something that is kind of as a function of industrial development getting more and more widespread around the world. I, as I mentioned, work primarily in China, and it's periodically in the news that China has some sort of water scarcity challenges, and it does, but those really pale by comparison with water quality challenges. In the last census that the Chinese government conducted, about 35% of water bodies throughout China had what's called grade 5 water quality, which is the worst level, and it's sort of unfit for any human contact. That's an astonishing level for a country like China, if you think about the geographic kind of coverage that entails. And you're seeing that pattern being repeated across other rapidly developing countries, again, like India, several African countries as well. So it's a challenge that even as we face new issues in the developed world and in the West and even here in Philadelphia with water pollution and contaminants, it's something that's also getting to be much more of a problem elsewhere in the world. And it's probably implicit, but along with the threat to human health, you just have to start thinking about economic impacts. If you have to treat, if the water quality is so bad that you have to treat it even before you would use it for an industrial process or for irrigation, that creates an enormous economic burden on society. And in fact, I might just quickly, one more point on that, say when I was at the World Bank, we did a study in which we estimated that water pollution alone adds up to about a 2% or so drag on China's GDP, which is, again, a pretty astonishing figure, because we didn't take into account air pollution or any other form of pollution, just water pollution alone. I did promise that Philadelphia and the Philadelphia region, as well as kind of telling us the story of the world's water challenges, also has given birth to some of the solutions to these challenges too. And I'm going to turn to that now. So the first of these challenges is really one of equity and justice. Water isn't like most other resources in that you, perhaps needless to say, can't deprive anyone of it for any meaningful length of time. Certainly, you wouldn't want to be without light or power or food, but there's something even more kind of vital and fundamental to the existence of all life in the case of water. And you know, there's when you're in the water business, there's a relatively small number of water puns and cliches that are constantly kind of rolled out. But there is one that I do find quite touching, which is that when we look outside our own planet for life, the first thing that we look for are signs of liquid water. And I do think that is a meaningful kind of way of describing just how critical water is to all life on this planet, perhaps even others as well. But suffice it to say, there's this sort of issue of equity and justice that's inherent when you're talking about supplying or managing water that isn't quite as pronounced in the case of almost any other resource. And the way that that kind of challenge is really manifested, or the way it kind of really hits home, is in the fact that supplying water, and particularly clean water, is very expensive. Almost everywhere in the world, it's subsidized to some extent by taxpayers and by the public purse. And that is in many ways well justified, given that when you have the majority of a population, and of course ideally an entire population, that's able to get clean water from the tap or some other readily accessible source, that automatically cuts down disease burden. It automatically improves the ability of businesses, factories, et cetera, to conduct all farmers as well. To conduct various types of economic activities. So there are a tremendous number of benefits or public goods that come out of the ready supply of clean water. But it is extraordinarily expensive, and it's getting more expensive, partly because in most parts of the world, the infrastructure that we rely on for water supply is rapidly aging. And interestingly, that's true not just in developed countries and regions like Philadelphia, but even cities like Nairobi or Dhaka, because the water supply systems in those countries were originally built by colonial powers, for the most part, around the same time, in the typically either the late 19th or early 20th century. So interestingly, even in places that have developed economically much later, you have a comparable kind of age of infrastructure that needs to be upgraded to support growing populations, changing economic activity, and in some cases, as I mentioned earlier, these kind of emerging water quality issues or threats. All of that, of course, takes money, and typically the way that you raise money for those types of investments is from water tariffs, from fees that you levy on the use of water. It's obviously extremely unpopular to raise prices on water, and in some cases, of course, there is a real kind of moral or ethical argument against doing it. In 2003, the city of Philadelphia, again having one of the older water supply systems in the United States and kind of facing this challenge a little bit earlier than some other cities, created something called the Tariff Assistance Program. And actually, I'd be curious to know how many of you are City of Philadelphia residents. Good portion, as I expected. So the City of Philadelphia is very unusual among municipalities in the United States. And by the way, something I should make sure to point out, Philadelphia is not quite the first municipal water supply system in the United States, but it's one of the earliest, and that was actually something that came out of the yellow fever epidemic that struck Philadelphia at the end of the 18th century. City fathers at the time were convinced that it was spread through contaminated water, and they decided that clean water should be supplied not just as a private service, which had often been the case in England, for example, but actually as a public service through a municipally owned and operated utility. Still around today, of course, is the Philadelphia Water Department. But this program, skipping forward a century and a half or so, the Tariff Assistance Program, unlike most cases in which your water bill is based on how much water you use, pretty simple, intuitive kind of principle, it's actually indexed to both income and household size. So in a way, it's almost like translating the principle of progressive income tax to water, where you're saying you can use a certain amount of water at a relatively low tariff rate, and then the more you use and the higher your income is, the more that you're gonna pay for it. That has received a lot of recognition nationwide as a potential model for how you might be able to sort of responsibly implement water pricing. Some of you, as City of Philadelphia residents, and I am not a City of Philadelphia resident, might have other thoughts about your water bills that you can feel free to share. But in that particular regard, City of Philadelphia is actually viewed as a national and even an international model. And suffice it to say, this kind of challenge of how you balance generating more revenue for municipal water networks while also protecting the poor and disadvantaged from large water price increases, that's something that's a common challenge for every city in the United States virtually, as well as almost every major city in the developing world as well, which is interesting because that's very rarely the case where you have that kind of degree of overlap in challenges between the developed and developing world. Second major kind of solution or set of solutions that we can celebrate here in Philadelphia, infrastructure. So along with raising money and ultimately the reason that you need to generate this additional money in the water sector, it's because if we think about the next couple decades of climate change, we're going to have to build a lot more stuff to protect what we currently have. Here in Philadelphia, one major kind of issue that people are talking about, the main water intake for the City of Philadelphia is located not too far upriver on the Delaware. Now, the Delaware is, of course, a tidal river, so there's something called the salt line, which varies seasonally and at different times of the year in terms of where it sits. But basically, that's where you start. That's the boundary or the interface between fresh and salt water. Well, as the sea level has been rising over time, the salt line has been steadily retreating. At some point in the near future, the salt line will, on average, reside north of the main water intake, meaning that you will have to shift, well, theoretically, you could put in a desalination facility or something, but that's sort of a side note. Basically, it'll mean you'll have to move the main water intake further north. That'll entail a pretty significant redesign of the entire city water supply and distribution network. And that's really just one example of the type of infrastructure needs that you're going to have to think about for climate change. The other big issue is protecting against increasing flooding or storm surges, and how you might protect against that through seawalls or things like that. This, as you can tell, starts to get real expensive, real complex, real difficult, real fast. Fortunately, Philadelphia has shown us that there is another way, at least in some cases, which is to build with nature. If any of you have ever sort of heard the phrase designing with nature, that's actually a phrase and a concept that originated here in Philadelphia, specifically at Penn, through a landscape architect named Ian McHarg back in the 1960s. And still today, Philadelphia is one of the kind of main practitioners of that principle. Specifically, in the case of water, what Philadelphia has done over the last couple of decades is to say, instead of trying to spend a lot of money building more stuff to treat our water and purify it to a greater extent, what if we instead rely on nature to do it for us? More specifically, Philadelphia, like a lot of cities, uses something called combined sewer overflow, which essentially means that when you have a lot of rainfall, it's a combined network of where that water rushes down and where sewage kind of is piped through. Essentially, you're making use of the same distribution network to try to flush the maximum amount of rainfall through the city as quickly as possible. What that means, of course, is that you end up with a lot of untreated sewage that flows out into the Schuylkill and the Delaware. What Philadelphia has tried to do is to instead of just pump all that stuff out as quickly as possible, which was the previous model, to try to retain it for at least a period of time using kind of natural filtration. So specifically these things called retention ponds. It's essentially like an earthen lined pond that you would channel the sewage into, and if it's left there for a period of time, it's naturally filtered out, both by the soils as well as typically you have plants that help to kind of filter the water. This type of natural capital investment, as it's also called, is emerging really rapidly as a key solution, both to dealing with these kind of water quality and water pollution problems that we see around the world, as well as to this challenge of how you try to prevent flooding and other types of storm surge. Because in addition to filtration, these types of natural capital investments, at least when they sit along a river or a waterway, they provide a natural buffer. When there's a flood, it just floods the grass. It doesn't flood an apartment building. So these types of investments are rapidly becoming widely favored as a solution. Doesn't work everywhere, and I can certainly get into that, but when I was at the World Bank, that was something we were really trying to push countries all around the world to think about. Instead of replicating what we did in the 19th and 20th centuries and just rely on big concrete and steel infrastructure solutions to prevent flooding and purify water, think about whether you can use natural ecosystems, essentially, to try to do at least part of that for you. The third and final contribution to, I think, solutions that Philadelphia and Philadelphia region has given us has to do with cooperation. How many of you have kind of heard the phrase, the wars, something along the lines of the wars of the future will be fought over water? Anybody sort of heard that? Very commonly kind of repeated assertion. And actually that's the thing that, in terms of my research, I've spent most time on. I think that's essentially totally false assertion. We can get into that. But certainly, whether or not you agree with me when I say that, one key aspect of solving all of these problems is cooperation, and cooperation on at least three major dimensions. cooperation between water users. So when you think about it, we all use water quite differently. As City of Philadelphia residents or urban residents, we use water very, very differently than people in Lancaster County use water who may be more involved in agriculture. Similarly, we would all use water quite differently to frackers in the Marcellus shale. And yet all of those uses of water are fundamentally tied together. If you were to try to design a responsible way of managing water, you would need to find some way of getting all those groups of people together and agree on certain principles of how common sources of water, whether it be the Delaware, the Susquehanna, et cetera, should be managed, should be allocated, should be governed. Second major dimension is jurisdictionally. So if you look both at this region where our major river, the Delaware, is shared between New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Delaware, well, that's true of essentially every major river and lake in the entire world. Almost nowhere do you have political boundaries that kind of fit neatly into the boundaries of a watershed or a river basin, which means that anytime you're talking about managing or governing a body of water like that, you're talking about an exercise in interjurisdictional cooperation. Very often that's true of countries, so you'll have, that's a problem of international relations, but it's almost everywhere a problem of intergovernmental relations between cities and municipalities, counties, states, and provinces. The third major dimension is sectoral. So again, you have very, very different water use demands when you're in agriculture versus industry versus an urban resident, and yet an agribusiness or an individual farmer is just set up as a corporate entity so differently from a Comcast or a PG&E to a household living in the city of Philadelphia. And so you sort of have this three-part challenge of you have to have cooperation between water user groups, you got to have cooperation between sectors, and then you got to have cooperation between jurisdictional units. So you might guess that's a pretty hard problem to try to solve. We don't have a lot of great models around the world of how to do that, except for one that happens to be right next door. It's actually headquartered in West Trenton, and it's something called the Delaware River Basin Commission. Has anyone heard of DRBC? Have some experience with it? Excellent. So DRBC is a fascinating entity, and I'll just close by telling you a little bit about it. Originally set up in the early 1960s, in an interesting period, right at, in the sort of post-war era, when the federal government, and it's sort of hard to imagine this period now, but the federal government was extremely concerned about natural resource issues. And if you kind of think about that period historically, you had this huge economic boom after the Second World War and after this period in which the nation's resources had been mobilized for the war effort. There was this kind of great, and I don't mean great in a qualitative sense, but just massive degree of government involvement in the nation's resources. And there was a sort of precedent for trying to manage and harness all of the nation's natural resources. 1960, something called the Water Resources Act was passed that actually empowered states to set up river basin commissions for shared river basins, basins that were shared between states. That was a critical innovation in the sense of water, because before that, there was only really one legal mechanism that existed for states to share water or to try to figure out how to jointly manage water resources, and that was the Interstate Compact, the most famous of which is the Colorado River Compact in the southwestern U.S. Again, something we could talk about if people are interested. But this in the 1960s was a totally different model, because what it said is instead of just having a treaty between, effectively, between state governments, what we want to set up is kind of like a group, an organization that'll provide a regular platform for representatives of the different states and at least in theory the different water user groups and sectors that those states represent to get together and talk and make consensus-based decisions about how to use water collectively and cooperatively. That was a pretty new model for the United States at the time, but there was something that was very particular, and so there were about a dozen of these commissions that were set up different parts of the country, but the Delaware River Basin Commission ended up being a bit special because it, along with the Susquehanna River Basin Commission, which was a kind of sister entity set up a few years, about a decade later, in 1973, if I remember correctly, completely unique in American law in that it is an organization that's backed up by a compact, but unlike every other compact, which just involves state governments, these two compacts had the federal government as a legal party to the compact. This might sound a little in the weeds, a little legalistic, but what it means is that these are the only two bodies in the United States that bring together representatives of all state governments, which share a common water resource, along with the federal government, which, for better or worse, we can get into that, inherently has a role to play in things like flood control, regulating water quality, et cetera. And again, we can get into this in some detail in terms of how the DRBC, Delaware River Basin Commission, has functioned. But suffice to say, over the last 50 years or so, it's gotten the region through some pretty contentious issues over allocation, over how much water New York is allowed to divert upstream of us versus Pennsylvania versus what's kept in flow downstream, over things like salinization, over things like water quality, much more successfully than many other parts of the world. And these very same issues have really led lots of other regions around the world into some degree of conflict. So it's an institutional model that is really, I think we should be quite proud of. And again, when I was at the World Bank, we actually would frequently cite the Delaware River Basin Commission as one model for countries like China to try to replicate as they deal with the types of challenges that the Delaware River Basin Commission and this region as a whole has faced over the last century or so. I think I would like to bring it to a close there to make sure that we have a little bit of time for some discussion and questions. But I thank you again for coming and look forward to hopefully some discussion. Thank you.